And you're tuned to 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're speaking with Melody Feldman. She is a 47-year-old activist who began a unique program called Building Bridges for Peace 10 years ago under a nonprofit organization called Seeking Common Ground. For the past 9 summers, a Colorado-based organization has been bringing teenage girls from Israel, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip together to attend a 3-week camp in the Rocky Mountains. Hello, Melody.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
I want to talk about the program that you started, Building Bridges for Peace, in a moment, but maybe first you can tell us a little bit about your background.
I live in Colorado. I've been here the last 23 years, but I grew up in Miami, and I was raised a practicing Jew from the conservative movement, and as I was growing up, had issues with discrimination because I was Jewish in the public schools that I attended, and at one point faced a lot of discrimination based on my religion. I was beaten up. I was asked not to come to parties at my school because of my religious background, and found it really difficult at times even to attend school because I was one of 3 Jews attending a pretty white Christian community, and had friends actually crying because I was going to rot in hell for not believing and accepting in Jesus Christ. So it was a rough beginning there, but it sort of motivated me when I was younger to ask the question, why was I being singled out, and why did people dislike me if they didn't know me? And my feeling was if they knew me, we really could work together. And early on I started in those days you were allowed to talk about religion in school, and I started a class where we could come together and talk about our different religious practices and beliefs. And what I found was that people really were into learning about each other, and the more we discussed who we were, the more those barriers were broken down. That's my early years. I grew up, I became an Orthodox Jew for a number of years, my teen years and early 20s, and got a taste for what it was like to live in an Orthodox Jewish community, and soon grew out of that in my experiences. It was wonderful to have the experience to understand that community, but also coming from a pretty liberal Jewish home, wanted to explore other things in the world, and went to a very liberal college for school, and got into the area of human services and social work and working with people from other parts of the world, and sort of expanded, you know, the work that I was interested in doing and expanded my own personal belief system. It's a little bit about me.
Mm-hmm. You're still a practicing Jew. You're practicing Reconstructionist Jew?
A Reconstructionist Jew. Mm-hmm. I have a family here in Colorado, a son who's about to graduate high school, and my husband and I. And so, you know, we do traditional Friday night dinner here. The Reconstructionist movement is a movement that says that in every generation you reconstruct the religious beliefs and purposes to fit. It comes from a more ecological and activistic background.
Now, there was a period in which you, I'll just point out that I actually heard about you from reading an article in Hope magazine. There's an excellent article in the latest Hope magazine about you and your program and the girls who come and take part in it. And in the article, it mentions that there was a time in which you had a strong anti-Arab bias, and they actually describe, well, the author, Jana Graber, describes how you at one point were active in a Jewish political group, and quote you as saying, "Things were heating up in the Middle East, and we were trying to educate the public on how dangerous the Palestinians were. We even made up brochures talking about how we had to defend ourselves." Now, she mentions that you held those views until you went to Israel to visit with your mother in 1987. You'd already visited Israel several times before that, but on this trip you point out that you met with an Orthodox rabbi there who wanted peace. And a quote here from you, if I wanted to know what was really going on, it took me up to a hill where we could look down and see the army and their tanks and the Palestinians throwing rocks back from the other side. Now, can you describe your previous anti-Arab bias and how you changed?
Sure. You know, it wasn't an anti-Arab bias because I had been traveling to the Middle East, Israel in particular, since 1969, so I was a young teenager. And there were Arabs living in Israel, and at the time they were called Israeli Arabs. And it wasn't a fear or a bias against them, but it was a bias against those that called themselves terrorists. It was a bias against those that were bombing buses, some of which I'd lived in the country and had actually ridden on those buses. It was a fear growing up that we were told that there were people out there that wanted to kill us and harm us, but it was told from one perspective, a Jewish perspective, and a Jewish historical perspective. So it wasn't as if I was in Israel and I hated Arabs, but there was a fear and a consciousness, you know, that was imparted in my growing up that there were people out there that wanted to harm me. And then I saw it when I was there, but what I didn't have was the other perspective and understanding that. So in 1987, when I was in my early 30s, I was visiting again on one of my many visits, and at that time I was delivering a package to this rabbi. And it was at that time in 87 in December when the first Intifada began. And he lived in a neighborhood that was mixed with Arabs and Jews, and on this hill you could look down and you could see the tanks on one side and you could see the young boys throwing stones and smudging tires so that they couldn't see each other. And it was at that time that he actually used the word Palestinian. And previous to that, that word was something except for the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Palestinians, Arabs, hadn't identified themselves as that, or at least the lexicon wasn't that they were called Palestinians. And that was the first wake-up call for me, or realization, and giving a name and a face to these people that I had called my enemy. And by doing that, there was something in me that really was awakened. And here, living in America, and again, coming from a very liberal family and coming from a very liberal community, we were working for everybody else's human rights and injustices. But when it came to Arabs, when it came to Palestinians, that was different. And all of a sudden, I could not see what was different about that. And it was the first step in my taking a mirror and looking at myself and saying, you know, you can't pick and choose what's right and wrong. And that's when I started to begin to read a different history and a different perspective.
What's wrong with having an anti-terrorist bias or a bias against people who bomb buses? I mean, I would feel that that was perfectly fine to have a bias against that.
Well, I think I don't condone the violence, and I don't condone the violence on either side, on Israel's side, with what I would call institutionalized violence with the army in going into the West Bank, and I don't condone the violence of blowing up buses and bombs and really any violence. However, I really wanted to understand what would motivate someone, because I don't believe that we're born with the idea that we're going to strap bombs to our bodies and go and kill people, or that we're going to all grow up to be soldiers. I mean, I think something happens to create that mentality on both sides. And that mentality comes from a place of fear and a place of anger and a place of hopelessness. But I couldn't articulate that before, and I especially couldn't articulate it from the side of a Palestinian. And what I also learned was that, you know, one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. And so there was something to be learned in understanding the other person's perspective, and there is something to be learned. Because I think once you learn the motivation, there may be, and in my case with the organization that I have, there are ways to counter why we grow up and assume these roles and use violence as a way or a means to justify our existence.
There are those who would argue that the violence on the Palestinian side originates from hate education, that these people are raised from a very young age simply to hate Jews because they're Jews and they must be killed. Is that your experience in working with Palestinians or having traveled in the region?
My experiences on both sides, and those are blanket generalizations, and yes, there are schools and there are religious institutions on both sides, I might add, and there are communities that teach that from an early age, and it's based on their experiences on both sides as well. However, there are other communities where that's not taught. I'm talking in the Arab community, and I'm talking in the Jewish community, and those people are put into that gross generalization, number one. But what I do find, number two, is that on both sides of the experience, and I'm talking very specifically Israelis, Jews, and Arabs who live in Israel and held Israeli citizenship, and Arabs, Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza, they have no contact with each other. And all they're inundated with is the news that they receive, or actually living in those conditions. You know, I have kids that come to this program who have witnessed bombings on buses, who have lost family and friends. I have Palestinian students who live under closure in the communities, in the Arab towns and villages, who aren't allowed to go to university or go to school on a daily basis because it's too dangerous or because they're restricted. They've lost family members. They have family members sitting in jail who have just been rounded up and being held without any reason. And so by the time I see them, by the time they come to camp, they've lived in situations that just promote that anger, that hate, that hopelessness.
Let's, if you don't mind, I'll quote again from the article Peace Talks from Hope, the latest Hope magazine. At the beginning, she describes a Palestinian young woman named Inas. 19-year-old Inas had traveled to New Jersey from her home near Jenin in the West Bank to sit and talk with 22 Palestinian and Israeli teenage girls. As they sat in a circle at a New Jersey estate in summer, their faces a mixture of apprehension, fear, and hope, they gazed at each other, seeing the enemy. All Israelis and Americans, Inas believed, were her enemies. The only Jews she knew carried guns and drove tanks, the same tanks and guns that kept her father from reaching the hospital when he had a heart attack last year. Now, her widowed mother worked long hours in the olive groves to support her six children, and Inas wondered if she would be able to continue her university studies in hospital management. Her mother could not afford the tuition, and the Israeli-mandated curfews often kept her from attending class. Anger and frustration spilled over into her quiet words to the Israeli girls. "If you call us terrorists, then I am proud to be a terrorist." Her words struck deep into the hearts of the teens listening, yet all of them, regardless of their various political beliefs, had come to take part in this program, Building Bridges for Peace, to take the first step toward understanding the, quote, other side. And then if you, I'm just going to read a quote from the end of the article. Inas, who came into the program hating Jews, now converses often with her Israeli friends. Quote, "I began to look at the Israeli girls as individuals, not as a group," she says. I see that not all Jews are soldiers. They are human beings just like us. Though she still has disagreements with her Jewish friends, Inas says that this is not enough to keep them apart. Although it can be risky, former participants meet in Jerusalem or elsewhere whenever they can. Others keep in contact by phone, email, or in an internet chat room they've established. "I have changed," Inas says. "Before, I only saw myself, my hurts, my pain. Now I also think of my friends and the pain of others." There are times when people in the Palestinian community wonder how she can befriend Jews. Quote, "I tell them they are just girls, kids like us," says Inas. "Now many of my Palestinian friends are curious. They, too, would like to attend the program." Inas dreams of the day when Israelis and Palestinians will live side by side in peace. "Someday I will tell my children I have Jewish friends," she says. "But my hope is that they will believe this is nothing unusual because they will have Jewish friends themselves." And another thing that Inas says is that this program has done what their leaders could not do and has brought love between Israelis and Palestinians. So is this the norm in the program?
This is the norm.
Really?
And she's such a great example. I mean, she came off and was interviewed and basically said, you know, not only am I proud to be a terrorist, I understand why they want to blow up buses, and basically said if I was asked to do that, I would do it. And, you know, 12 days later, with tears in her eyes, hugging and clinging on to her friends who were Jewish, and saying that she couldn't believe she felt that way because she had never had the opportunity and never had been told any differently or saw really anything different. And this was a young girl who I understood completely. And actually, I was, you know, every year I see these little miracles, because her father was in an ambulance suffering from a heart attack, and he wasn't allowed, the ambulance wasn't allowed to get to the hospital. There was an Israeli blockade. And so he died in the ambulance. And I understood where she was coming from with that anger and that pain. And to be able, 12 days later, after having the ability to meet with and talk to and live with, you know, those that she considered her enemy, to be able to look them in the eyes and say, you know, you're just like me, is what we find the norm.
Now, let's go into how this program started. It started 10 years ago?
A little over 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. We had our first program in 94, but we started working on it in 92.
Okay, so it's been 9 summers now that you've had these camps.
Right.
And they're 3 weeks long?
Correct.
And that seems like a very short time for people to have such a major turnaround. Can you speculate as to how this happens?
The first thing we do when they come is we let them know that here, we take away all of their passports and all of their documents, and what we let them know is that here everybody's equal, the playing field is equal, and we create a community for them that's safe, and we continue to let them know that this is a place where governments and family members and community people are not going to intrude, and that they have the ability and the right to say what's on their mind as long as no violence is used. And so we create opportunity after opportunity, 24 hours a day for all of these days that they're together, to give them this permission to talk. Some of the girls come with the intention that they're going to meet their enemy, and they have this opportunity to tell them everything that they think about them, and it's not pleasant. Some of them come with a true desire to create a peaceful community and that they're here to meet and to understand the other. Some of them come because their families told them, this is your opportunity to really give it to the other side and let them know all the injustices that have been done. And so they're all coming with all different reasons, but when they get there, they're treated equal, and they're told that they have the ability and the right to talk to the other person and let them know what they're feeling and thinking. And then we set it up so that they have the opportunity to do this through a set of communication workshops that we give them on how you tell your story so that you can be heard and how you're going to listen to things that are very difficult to hear. And so there's an example set in the program by the staff, and the staff is representative of those that are there. So we have Palestinian staff, Israeli staff, American staff, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish staff that provide a safe space for these young people to talk. And it's genuine, and there's a lot of respect, and there's a lot of dignity for each other. And it's tested all the time. It's not easy, but over and over again, these kids are given permission. I don't want to hear them tell, you know, happy stories. I want them to have the opportunity to tell these stories that have dramatically impacted their lives. And the other thing is that they have the opportunity. It's not just the 3-week summer program. This program goes all through the year. And once they get back into their communities, they continue to meet with each other. And the last couple of years, because of the recent intifada and violence, they haven't had the opportunity to meet as often face-to-face. But I do have to tell you, after this summer's program, they said that they were going to meet again when they got back within 10 days. And I knew that there were closures. I knew that it was going to be difficult for the kids from the West Bank to come inside Israel and to meet in Jerusalem. But they asked that I, you know, be able to provide them the funds to be able to do the follow-up work. And 10 days later, they called me from a place, an undisclosed place inside of Israel, where they had all met. It was a camp setting, and everyone was there. And the kids from the West Bank had come into Israel. They met in Jerusalem with some of the other kids. They got on a bus. They met with the Israelis. They got on the bus, and they went up to this place. And one of the Palestinian mothers went with them and cooked for them the whole weekend. And they ran a 4-day workshop to continue the work. And it's unheard of what they managed to do.
Now, in the article in Hope Magazine, Latest Hope Magazine Peace Talks about this program, Building Bridges for Peace, that we're talking about here. The author quotes you as having said, "My expectation is not that they become friends or even agree rather that they have a chance to be heard. Pain often comes from feeling ignored. Healing comes from the ability to tell your story to the person that you perceive as the enemy. So that's a big part of it. That's a big part of this program. Not just bringing people together, but giving them an opportunity to tell their who they perceive as their enemy, all the hurts and injustices, and hopefully this leads to some healing.
Correct. I the intention when I first started the program really had nothing to do with the idea that they were going to come together and become friends. The idea was exactly what they quoted me in the article as saying, is that the ability to tell your story and the ability to tell your enemy, that the person who you perceive as your enemy, what you perceive they've done to you, what it's done to your life, to me is a healing, is a place of healing. If other things result from that, and it does, it often does, the fact that I look into your eyes and I see myself reflected back, that's often stated by the girls who've gone through the program, the idea that, wow, we have other things that we hold in common, family issues, what it's like just to be a teenager growing up, or you look just like me. When these kids get off the plane, you can't tell them apart, and they're shocked that they can't tell each other apart. So these other things come from this meeting, but the first reason why I put this together was to give them the opportunity to share their story, and it's very powerful.
Now, these Palestinian-Israeli teenage girls, they, when they're at the camp, they live, eat, hang out together.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of day-to-day things go on? Can you describe just a taste of the kind of day-to-day? I mean, you've already described some of the program aspects, but...
We have two workshops that we do during the day that address issues of communication and then issues that are specific to the communities that they come from. And we have four different groups that are in attendance. We have American girls from diverse backgrounds and religions that come to the camp. We have Palestinians who live in Israel and are Israeli citizens, and they have unique issues of being Palestinians living in Israel. We have Israeli Jews. And then we have Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza. So we also address the issues in each one of those communities. And that's addressed in other workshops. We talk about gender. We talk about politics. We have guest lecturers and people coming in to meet with the girls and to talk with them. We may take them out of camp. This year we did a trip to Washington, D.C., and introduced them to American government, to the Holocaust Museum, and to an institute, a nonviolent institute run through one of Gandhi's foundations. And then during the day, there's swimming, there's art. Art is a big part of our programming. And the art that we do is representative of the work that we're doing. It's another form of communication between the girls. And then just informally, being able to sit next to each other doing an art project and not focus so much on the issues that we've raised in our workshops, but to just to get to know each other on a personal level. Music and dance is very much a part of our program, and the girls bring their own music with them, and they can spontaneously break out into Arabic dancing, Israeli dancing, American hip-hop dancing, you know, so on and so forth. So part of the day is to give them the opportunity to informally just be with each other.
So despite the heaviness of a lot of this, the issues and the conflicts they have, the girls do have fun?
They have fun, and oftentimes they catch themselves in this strange position of having just come out of a very heated workshop or seminar, and they could be in tears, and then someone will put a CD in the player, and they will spontaneously break into joyous dance. And it's incredible to watch. We went bowling with them one night. A bowling alley opened up and really gave us a pizza party. And here they were, so segregated, and they themselves informally integrated into different bowling teams, helping each other, you know, walking down hand in hand and throwing the ball down the lane. And then they just started to sing songs in Arabic and Hebrew and English together. And it was just an incredible sight to behold.
Why teenagers and why girls in particular?
Teenagers because developmentally they're in that stage where they really do see things in black and white. Even though they like to think that they're all individuals, They really see things as either or. And what we're trying to do is show them the gray, and that this is something that they'll take into adulthood with them. I had an experience where I thought one way and held my perspective, but when I was in this group, all of a sudden I saw that there's all this gray, and it's not black and white, and it's something that they can take with them as they grow. We started working with young women because when I was in Israel and Palestine, I met with Palestinians and Israelis, peace activists, who said, if you're going to put a program together, we would love you to do something with women. And my background is in the area of women, the work that I've done previously. And they said, we just don't have good women's leadership programs. And in order for anything to change in the political scene in the Middle East, women are going to have to be a part of the process. And if you could help in facilitating growing good leaders, women leaders, this would help us. For the Palestinians trying to form a democratic state, their feeling is women have to be a part of that process. And again, they need these good women leaders. I believe personally that women look at the world from a different perspective than men, and that we have and should have a great influence on how we build peaceful communities.
So when the girls are at the camp, I'll just quote from the article Peace Talks again and get your response. The author, Jana Graber, mentions that it's not uncommon for you, Melody, to be working with the young people one-on-one at an arts table, working on projects with girls. She's been known to jump into lakes with her clothes on, dance Arabic belly dances, or play frisbee. What I like best are the informal conversations with the girls, says Feldman. I'm always looking for girls who are emotionally stuck. Those are the teens I want to have one-on-one conversations with, although I'm always open to any of the girls. So you work directly with them all day? You have informal conversations with them? Do you eat with them? Are you there constantly, 24/7?
I'm there the whole time. I'm going through the process with them. I have a wonderful staff that comes every summer. These are women who have been with me. Some of them have been participants themselves since they were 14 and 15 years of age, and some of them were there the first few years the program started. And we're there as a collective working together, and there's no magic formula. Every night we get together and we talk. We look at, you know, who we feel is withdrawn from the group, who we think is moving along, who's taking on a leadership position. We talk about, you know, where our strengths and weaknesses are in working with the young women. But I'm there. It's what gives me the energy and the motivation to keep doing this.
So now the program is organized by people in the Middle East, girls and women in the Middle East who have graduated from the program, who went through the program, right?
Correct. We were working with partners, both Palestinian and Israeli partners in this organization. And the last 2 years, even in Israel and Palestine, the peace movements have been so fractured by just the intensity of the violence and what's been going on that it's been more and more difficult for them to work together. But the young women, the alumni of the program, contacted me 2 years ago and said, of course we're going to do this, and of course we're going to get students, and we're going to do it now.
So now the program's run by students, but how is it, or former people who are in the program, how is it started? How did you manage to raise the funds, and how did you get the girls together?
The first time was I flew over to Israel when I had decided that I wanted to do the program, and I was introduced to, at that time in Palestine, there was no infrastructure. Arafat hadn't come back to Ramallah and Gaza, and so there was no government set up, no structure. I met with a private individual who was interested in doing this work, and she, a Palestinian woman, who said, tell me the parameters, and I will make sure that I get the families and the girls. And she did, and I was shocked. And then I went to some private contacts in Israel, and they also said, we want to be doing this, and we have connections with some of the peace organizations here, and we'll see what we can do. And I was there in May, and in August of 94, the summer of 94, was our first program. From then, I started to work with other organizations inside Palestine, There's an organization that I work with and in Israel, and these organizations work together as well. And again, the last 2 years, it's been pretty difficult for them to continue the work that they're doing. But they're there.
It's mentioned that Denver's Temple Emmanuel provided the startup funds. Are they still supporting the...
They do support us. We're independent of any other organization or institution, but they were extremely helpful. Rabbi Stephen Foster was the person who really helped secure funding for that first summer and for the next 3 summers after that.
And now it's a constant struggle to raise the money necessary to continue the program, right?
Exactly, and especially now, there's reluctance on the part of foundations for sure and individuals, because sometimes there's an equation of if I'm giving money to you, you're supporting, and you know, depending on which side of the fence they sit, they don't see it as a peace organization. Or I guess in this time in history, and especially now, people feel that to support this organization could be anti-American, it could be anti-Israel. And really what I'm saying is you're supporting the future of all of us by supporting the program.
We'll get at the end to how listeners can support it. I'm just going to quote again from the Peace Talks article. Not everyone has a positive view of Feldman's work. Some even oppose it. This is your quote. Sometimes after I speak, people come up and ask, how can you be helping those monsters? It's usually those who have not faced their fears about the conflict who oppose our work, whether they be Jewish or Palestinian. I've been called a moral relativist because I see both sides of the conflict. I understand the fear of Israelis and understand how it paralyzes you, but I see the same fear in the eyes of Palestinians. And she also mentions in the article, working toward peace brings criticism from communities on both sides of the conflict. Camp attendees report being harassed and criticized by family and friends for their newfound views. Befriending the, quote, enemy can be dangerous. So what personal experiences have you had with opposition, and how do you respond? And also the girls go home to a lot of this. And how do they respond?
For me personally, I've been doing it for so long, and when I really can sit down and talk one-on-one with individuals, more often they see, first of all, the passion and the hope and the stories that I can tell, where I've been in situations and I've seen, I've met with thousands of Palestinians, and I can relate stories that they've never heard before. And in most cases, people want to know that there's hope out there. They want to know that it isn't as bad as it's being written about all the time in the media, and I provide those stories. And it tends to lessen the impact of the feeling that they have that this is negative. Other times, you know, I always say, and I said in the article, we really only have 3 choices. We can stand still and feel paralyzed. We can move backwards and I think really harm ourselves and the world. Or we move forward, even if it's at small steps. And I'm just willing to do that because I always feel that moving forward keeps me going and keeps us spinning as a world. And so I don't stay in that place of dwelling on the negative that other people say about the program or what we're trying to accomplish, mostly because I get to see such positive things come from the program.
How do the girls respond once they're back home and they get all this resistance often? I'm not saying they always do, but it sounds like they often get resistance from their family and friends.
One thing is that the girls have learned a form of communication where they really have this skill to be able to listen to people with different viewpoints. And it's sort of disarming when you sit across from someone that you have opposing views with, but you continually ask what we call curious questions, and you draw them into the conversation as opposed to alienating them. So they may get into these heated discussions, but then the family members or the friends, you know, often say to them, God, you've changed, and what's changed about you is I could be sitting here telling you all these negative things, and yet you're still here and you're listening. And that makes a big impact on them. The other thing is there's more curiosity on both sides. First, there's anger, or there's resentment, or there's, you know, you're a traitor, you're talking to the enemy, or how could you like the enemy? But then it turns to curiosity, and that's probably the thing that moves these girls along the most. And I'll tell you a quick story. There was a young woman who's been in the program a number of years, and she lived in East Jerusalem. She's Palestinian, and she went to school in Jenin for the first time a year ago, and things were terrible. And here she had all these Israeli and Jewish friends, and she talked about the program all the time. She lived with her family in Jenin, her extended family. And every time there was a bombing in Israel and a bus bombing and Jews lost their lives, she would cry. And her family, this extended family, would cheer. And she would get into arguments with them and say, you know, these are people who, these are mothers who are losing their children, and it's just like us. And she stayed, and she kept after them and telling them this, you know, month after month. And finally, one day, one of her cousins came to her and said, you know, I want to know about this program. I want to know more about this, because I can't believe that after all these months living here and seeing how horrible our life is under, you know, Israeli occupation, that you still think that this program works and that you still want to befriend Jews. So there's that living testimony from the girls themselves. The other thing is we do have to be careful, and I'm very, very aware of the fact that some of these girls are going back not only into homes but communities where this isn't looked upon favorably, and in some cases it is detrimental physically, you know, for their safety. And so we work with organizations, with adults in their communities who will support them. I don't want to be in a situation where I'm putting anybody at risk going back for their personal safety.
You're tuned to 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz, and I'm speaking with Melody Feldman. She's a 47-year-old activist who began a unique program called Building Bridges for Peace 10 years ago under a nonprofit organization called Seeking Common Ground. For the past 9 summers, the Colorado-based organization has been bringing teenage girls from Israel, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip together to attend a 3-week camp in the Rocky Mountains. And as you mentioned, some American girls also attend, of different ethnic backgrounds. So let's just ask a few more questions and wrap up here. There's a documentary called Imagining Peace being made about the program, Building Bridges for Peace. Can you talk a little bit about that? When is it going to be available? Is it already available? What do you think it's going to be like?
Lisa Gossels is the film director, and she approached me over a year and a half ago to do something when she heard some of the girls speak in Colorado and in New York City. And she was at the program last summer and is following the girls now for at least a year, and will be back at the summer program this year when we do it at the end of August. And I'll be traveling over to Israel and Palestine in May, the end of May, and she'll be there again to meet with the girls and do follow-up. So the documentary will probably not be available for a couple of years, but once it is, we'll be using it for educational purposes. Really to bring into the community to show what happens when you bring people together and give them the opportunity to meet face-to-face. And she also is in a situation where, you know, at this time and place in the world, raising funds for a peace project for documentary film is also difficult. So she's raising funds for that as well as doing the editing of the program. And it's a documentary really based on the program, meeting the girls that came last summer to the program and following them for a year. So you not only see what they went through in the program, but you see them at home. There are interviews with family members before they came over last summer, and there's follow-up interviews with them, as well as just seeing the work that we do.
Now, you have hopes to expand this program, although it currently is hard for you to even raise the funds to keep this going, but you've reached out to some other folks and actually expanded the program, right, to Northern Ireland?
We do another program, and that's in partnership with Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City, and they are a nationally known interfaith seminary, and we've done a program with them for the last 2 summers, and we'll be doing it again this summer called Faith to Faith, and this is an interfaith program with both young men and young women, high school students. And we select students from Northern Ireland, South Africa, Israel, Palestine, and the United States. And this program looks at the role that religion plays in waging war and making peace in the world. So it's part mostly the political conflicts from which these students have come from and the religious conflicts that they come from. And it's also based, predicated on the work that we did with Building Bridges for Peace, communication workshops, panels, seminars, the ability for these young people to live together in a summer program for 3 weeks.
Now, in the article, Peace Talks, again, I'll quote from it, the author, Jonna Graber, points out, while the, quote, troubles in Northern Ireland may look different from the, quote, conflict in the Middle East, the same concerns are played out. Land issues, class struggles, indigenous people versus immigrants, and two sides looking at each other with mistrust. Do you view the situations as similar personally, or would you disagree with that?
No, I agree with that, and the kids themselves agree with that. You know, they, for them, in this program face-to-face, what's really compelling is when you take students from different conflicts around the world, all of a sudden they put into context where they are in their conflict. One of the Northern Ireland girls a couple of years ago said, you know, when I look at South Africa, they're so much farther ahead than all of us. They've gone through apartheid, and they're out the other side, and they're really working on reconciliation. Because the students talk a lot about what it's like being teenagers and where their countries are in this conflict, and the kids that we get are in the midst of it. She said, and I look at Israel, and I see that, you know, Israel and Palestine are so far behind in the conflict, and it's so heated, and there's so much immediate violence. And then I look at us in Northern Ireland and I say to myself, you know, we've come so far and there's so much ahead, but I can look at South Africa and I can look at the United States and I can say, wow, you know, we can have this too. So it's helpful for them. The conflicts are different in that the issues are different, the outcomes are the same, people are dying, and young people, teenagers, don't have the ability to grow up and just to be teens. And over again, this is what I hear the young people say to me at night in tears. I just want to be 16 years old. I just want to go to school. I just want to be with my friends. I don't want to worry about getting on a bus and wondering if I'm going to come home at night. I don't want to be cooped up in my house under occupation. I don't want to be told that I can't go into a neighborhood because I'm not Catholic or I'm not Protestant.
In this article, again, I'll quote, Rhea Dowling, age 17, attended face-to-face last year. Born in London, she moved to Northern Ireland when she was 14. She says, I moved from a multicultural society to a society so closed off and segregated because of religion, people judge you before you even have spoken. Even your name will determine whether some people talk to you. And, it's, as she mentions in the article, such segregation stamps children with distorted and uninformed beliefs about the people on the other side, because I guess in Northern Ireland, Catholic and Protestant are often separated, living in segregated areas of town and don't really mix. And it seems that I've talked to people who've lived in Israel and who've been to the West Bank and Gaza, mostly Jewish people, but they say that oftentimes the Palestinians only see the soldiers and the tanks in the West Bank and Gaza, and that in Israel, many people don't travel to the West, many Israelis never go to the West Bank and Gaza, and all they see is the suicide bombings, and so both sides see only the most violent elements. Do you think that's an accurate depiction?
It is very accurate. I was in Belfast early in the year to meet with participants and their families from our program. And here I am, I mean, I've lived and worked in the Middle East for years, but I went to Belfast and I was so taken aback by the segregation. I'm Jewish and everybody asks you there, what are you? And they want to know, are you Catholic or Protestant? And I say, well, I'm Jewish. And their response to me was, yes, but what are you? And the sidewalks are marked with markings of whether or not you're Orange or Union Jack, Protestant or Catholic, and there's no escaping it. It's just pervasive, and you feel this heaviness as you walk through the streets. There are few and far between what they call mixed areas, and cross-community work, Protestants and Catholics working together, is still so dangerous. And in Israel and Palestine, I would go into the West Bank, and I would see a whole community and a whole way of life that I would say 90-95% of Israeli Jews never see, have never been a part of or privy to, and the vice versa, Palestinians, you know, not coming into Israel, although they do mix more in the Israeli society, in that they come and go, not so freely all the time, but there is more of them because the dominant culture is of the Jewish Israeli. So they see that more. But there's such fear. When these kids came the first year, I took them aside, Palestinians on one side and Israelis on the other, and if an artist had been there to draw, I asked the Israeli girls, tell me what you think of the Palestinians. What do they look like? And they had just been on a plane together. And if an artist had drawn a rendition, they looked like monsters, like aliens. And when I asked the Palestinians to physically tell me what Israelis looked like, they made them out to look like RoboCops. And one of the Palestinian girls said, there could be hundreds of them coming, and you can shoot them and kill them, but there'll be more behind them, and they'll just keep coming. And so these distorted images that they have of each other, even though they can fly on a plane together and see that that's not the case, what they've internalized is monsters and aliens and people made of steel.
I just have a couple more questions, and then we'll conclude with how people can help the program, and also if, I don't know if Lisa Gossels is wanting some funds to help her produce a documentary, Imagining Peace, but we'll get into how people can help in one way or another at the end. But just two more questions. I'd like to just quote again from the article one final time. Gal, a 17-year-old Israeli girl, has faced disapproval from her family for attending the camp. One aunt even tried to brainwash me not to go, Gal says. She told me Arabs only want to kill us. That was not the case. Instead, Gal met 19-year-old Razan, a Palestinian, and the two have become friends. We talk to each other all the time, Razan says. She's honest with me and tells me everything. Our friendship is built on trust and honesty. My enemy is actually my best friend. At times, it is hard for Gal to share her beliefs in the Israeli community. At first, she tried to speak out when others spoke ill of her friends or made jokes belittling Palestinians. I would shout at them or just get sick inside, she says. But these confrontations were upsetting, and now she chooses when to speak up and when to be silent. If the words come from a position of hate, I don't say anything, she says. But if they come from ignorance or misunderstanding, I speak up. Gal continues to be active in peace organizations. She gathers strength from Razan and other friends at building bridges, especially as she faces doing her mandatory military service next year. I still don't know how I feel about military service, says Gal. There are bad repercussions if you do not serve. Still, her experience with building bridges has changed how she will look at the Palestinian people that she will undoubtedly encounter. And one other quick quote. One young Israeli man who had lost several friends to the conflict came into the program wanting to kill as many Palestinians as possible when he got into the army. At face-to-face, he met a young Palestinian man his age. He soon found that the two had much in common. The young Israeli was a changed man, says Henderson. There's a human being now behind the word Palestinian. So again, your response to that. This is the norm. Do people ever come out of the program still hating one another or having very strong?
There are individuals who come out of the program feeling that there's so much unfinished business, as do all of them. You know, some of them will come up to me and say, I failed you. I'm not where you want me to be. And my response is, I have no set marks for any of you. This is a process. And for some of them, it may be the first year and the first time that they've encountered this. And there's so much that they have to go through. We had one young girl who, at the end of the program, a few years ago, we did a big breakfast for the community. So there were 400 people in a room, and we have some of the girls stand up and speak about their experiences. And one young Palestinian Israeli stood up and said, this is the worst program I've ever been through. It's racist. It's this. It's that. I didn't learn anything. I can't wait to go home. And just spewed her heart out. And went back home, and a year later called me and said, I want to come back to the program. And 2 years later, she's on a tour in the United States with Israelis, Jewish Israelis, talking about making peace. So it's a process that they go through, and they're all different places. From the time that Gal talked to the editor, the author of this piece, to a few weeks ago, I had an email from her. You know, she said to me, I'm a teenager, and every day I change my mind and I change my feelings. And some days, you know, she's like, I can't do this anymore. And other days, it's like, I'm ready to work for you. I'm coming over. I'm going to intern in your office. So I understand where they are as teenagers. I understand where they are in this conflict. You know, after a horrendous bus bombing or bombings in the West Bank or loss of friends or family members, it's very difficult. You know, they kind of have to pick themselves up off the floor and start again. So there are no expectations, and they leave the program in various stages.
I'm looking at a picture of some of the young women who've attended this camp, Building Bridges for Peace, and you're right, it's very difficult to tell the difference between Palestinians and Israelis in this picture. What I'm moved to when I see this is I feel a lot of things. I feel hopeful because they all are smiling. They look like, you know, I don't know at what point they are in the program, but they look like they just really like each other. I mean, they're all sitting very close, laying on one another, smiling. And I also feel fearful because I wonder what they're going to encounter when they go home. And I know that if there's an invasion of Iraq, that this situation is going to get far worse. Do you feel afraid for these girls when they return? Do you fear, for example, for the Palestinians that they, you know, the violence may escalate in the occupied territories? There may be attempts at transferring Palestinians out, I've heard. Mm-hmm. And also for the Israelis, the violence can mount. So what are your feelings on that?
You know, I'm in contact with them constantly through email and phone. And my emotions are all over the place because I'm greatly fearful for them on an individual level, what's happening on a day-to-day basis. When there are closures in the West Bank, I want to call and talk to them. And what's so amazing is the hopefulness that they have and the strength that they give me. You know, I'm calling them, and I'm not quite sure what to say, and they're responses, it's just good to hear a voice. It's good that we're in constant, you know, contact with each other and communication. We're going to get through this. And it's a fear that I have of the immediacy of what may happen. And that's why, you know, aside from the work that I'm doing with them, it's, you know, a plea for us not to go to war and to exhaust all other means that we have. You know, because I know that there are individual people that are going to have to deal with the consequences, that are living in life and death situations. And it's that personal connection that I have that makes everything that we do, our U.S. government does, come back to me and come back to these young people. And it's not just them, it's their families or it's the communities, because I've been there and I visited and I know the day-to-day life. But they give me strength, and, you know, they live for the program and the work that we do, and it's a continuum. And I have to say, on the other hand, that there's an awful lot of hope. I mean, I wake up every morning, and first of all, I'm really appreciative of everything around me, and that's something that this program has given to me. There's nothing in my life that I need, because I have it all, and that's what they taught me. And the other thing is that I see what happens, and I see, and the girls say this, when we get together, we see how the world could be, not the way that it is, and we know that we could have it.
I'm speaking with Melody Feldman. She's an activist who began a program called Building Bridges for Peace 10 years ago. She's brought 400 teenage girls,
yes,
through this program from Israel, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip, and they attend a three-week camp in the Rocky Mountains, and sounds like they come out transformed in many ways. So, Melody, how can people help? Is there volunteer opportunities? How can people donate? Does the documentary Imagining Peace need funds? How can people help?
You know, people don't want to hear this, but this is the reality. The reality is the money. The reality is the funding. We could be doing this program on an ongoing basis not just once a year and not just with 20 or 30 or 40 students, because there's that many there that want to participate in a program like this. And that's where we're going to see change. Families of the participants have requested that we do family work. And family work is incredible because then they come back to their communities, and it's not just a son or a daughter, but it's a family that comes back and says, wait a second, you know, there are people on the other side, and they're thinking just like us. And it's the money that we need. Our greatest sponsors are individual donors, small and large contributions. There are some opportunities, but our programs are so small right now, and my philosophy is that as many past participants that can come back and be staff is the first, you know, first group of people that we'd love to have come. So there's not a lot of opportunity to come and work the program, but I'm always interested in hearing from people who have special gifts or qualities, people who, especially in music and art, who can donate and give of their time is wonderful. Being able to support and get the word out about the work that we're doing is really important. And they can contact us directly. The film, Imagining Peace, is a very important part of the project because it will be used in schools and civic and religious institutions to really bring home the words of the participants in the program and for them to see what these young people go through. And it, you know, it costs $500,000 to put out a documentary these days, and that's on a shoestring budget. So if there are organizations and foundations out there that can give both to the organization and or to the documentary, it would just be wonderful in helping get the word out. And these students that come, these participants that come from the Middle East, are so grateful and amazed that there are Americans that want to support something like this and that care about them.
So where do people send donations, and do they make a check out to your organization, or do they make it out to Seeking Common Ground?
They can make it out to Seeking Common Ground. They can put down a memo on where they want it to go. It's a nonprofit organization. It's tax deductible. And they can go to our website, which is www.buildingpeace.org, and they can get information there about how to make contributions and where to send it to.
Mm-hmm.
They can call us at 303-698-9368, and I'll be happy to talk with them. Usually answer the phone. We're an office of two. Or they can send a check to Seeking Common Ground, P.O. Box 101-958, Denver, Colorado, 80250.
I'll mention those contacts again in a moment.
Right.
Melody, any final thoughts today as we wrap up?
You know, this is what I tell people when I talk all the time, is that we don't have to accept the way things are, and that each one of us really has the ability to make change in the world. And especially at this time when it feels so paralyzing and it feels so hopeless, that, you know, do one thing each day, make a conscious choice to do something that is building peace. And they're small little things, like walking into a store and acknowledging the person behind the counter that's helping you, being kinder in your family, getting on the Internet and finding organizations like moveon.com.org that, you know, is working for peaceful solutions. But don't sit paralyzed in your home and think that everything is hopeless. Go out there and do something.
Thank you so much, Melody.
Thank you.